this evening, I thought I'd talk about the right intention, because this is people get very confused by the way their mind is conditioned. So one gets caught in all kinds of doubts, mental confusion. Now they say in the monastic life, when a monk or nun takes the going forth in the upasampada, or the higher ordination, then their intention is to realize nibbana, in the Buddhist terms, or to have the ultimate realization of truth, to be enlightened. So that say our intention for taking this way of life, for practicing as Buddhist monks and nuns, is to realize the truth. If you realize nibbana, sounds maybe very strange to many of you. Realize the truth of the way it is. Be free from all delusions. Make your intention that kind of perfect intention. And this is done in a very deliberate, intentional way, intending to make the right intention. So that this is, and whether you think you can do it or not, or feel that it's possible or whatever, it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. We're not interested in how you might be reacting to this. Emotionally, you might feel totally unable to do anything, or you might feel that you're unworthy, or that it's too much to ask. But that's not the point. We're not asking you to make this from an emotional position, but to make this determination from a very as a determination from a cool place in yourself, neither high nor low. It's neither from inspiration, from being high and inspired, full of faith and hope and ecstasy, nor is it coming from a desperate attempt to get out of the misery and depression. So this is why when we're just in a kind of neither nor, in that cool rational place, our ability to think rationally, then we make that intention for our practice. So in the bhikkhu life definitely is, that's its purpose, its whole aim, and the reason for its existence is for that realization, ultimate realization in this human state. And that's like a guiding star. It's something to look toward, to remind yourself of, but not to attach to. And it also helps you to begin to realize or begin to look at the various ways you really feel about yourself. Like the self views will come up. I must do this. I should. I can't. I'm not good enough. How can anyone expect me to do that? Or you have maybe in an inspired state of mind. You feel very inspired by it all. You think, I want to devote my life to realizing the truth. I must, it's so wonderful. I love the Dhamma so much that I must dedicate my whole life to this wonderful pursuit. That, well, from a very high, maybe inspired mental state. So that you can realize when you're very high and you're very that is also a condition of the mind, inspiration and being high on thinking about the beauty and the loveliness of the Dhamma. But then if you're attached to that, to being inspired, you can easily completely crash into depression, thinking, I can't do it, I just not haven't enough strength to make it, and I'm a hopeless case. And that also is to be seen as a condition of the mind. All this sense of I can, I can't, I'm going to, when the positive side and the negative side is seen in, and because the intention is not from an inspiration, but from a deliberate rational choice, which helps to reflect for you the kind of feelings of being high and low, and what you think you can and can't do. And of course, the purpose is to realize that these are the arising and the ceasing of conditions. Now, when we attach to the idea of I am going to realize Nibbana and be perfectly enlightened as an attachment, then of course it blinds us. We're not like trying to keep your eyes focused on the guiding star. You fall over the cliff or trip over the stump because you don't see what's right in front of you. You're looking too high all the time. You're gazing up too high, so you can't see what's the next thing in front of you. But you need a direction, don't you? What are you here for? What are you doing meditation for? Do you want to just maybe live a happier life? Maybe work out your relationships in a better way? Maybe want to just get rid of a few unpleasant habits or problems, solve a few problems, or have a little peace of mind, or something like this? Is oftentimes our goals for meditation are still very worldly or earthbound. But what I'm suggesting is making the goal, the intention, the highest possible intention that a human being can realize. Perfect enlightenment, seeing clearly the truth, not being deluded, being liberated from all delusion. If you attach to that, though, then when you practice, you're always going to feel a sense of despair because I made my intention, but look at me now, I just can't do anything. I just feel this restlessness and anger, and I'm just feeling rotten and I can't do it. And therefore you're comparing the way you are, what you're experiencing now with an ultimate goal. And that's you're only going to come off the worse for it if you're comparing the present situation as is with the ideal. Recognize that an ideal is a guide, not an attachment. When we attach to ideals, we're always going to feel a sense of being worthless and hopeless. Perfectionist minds, aren't they, that always think in wanting the best of the best and how things should be. If everything were right and perfect, we can only feel discontented with what we have or the way we are. So we end up being cynics, isn't it? There's no, we can just maintain a level of negativity and just dwell on how imperfect and unsatisfying and how rotten the world is going to the opposite extreme. Some of the worst cynics were the greatest idealists, had the great hopes for creating the perfect society. Look at what happened to communism in the past few years. And that's definitely a high-minded ideal originally, wasn't it? Communists, Marxian communism based on very high view, a high-minded idea of a perfect society, a kind of supposedly based on some kind of somebody's theory of evolution. But the ideal was to create a perfect human society where everything is equal and all the kind of inequalities and unfairnesses have been discarded, and there is this wonderful result from this communist system. Wonderful idea, in fact, but when it intended to be imposed onto people, it ended up as a tyranny. Now contemplate this. If I should impose my ideas on you, force them down your throat, my ideas might be very good, isn't it? I might be forcing on you the best ideas. But when I'm shoving them down your throat, what are you feeling? Oppressed. So that some of the worst tyrants are idealists, because they're always telling you what you should do and how everything should be, and they're criticizing you because you're not living up to the high standards and ideas that they have. Now if I say to somebody, you should keep the moral precepts, and you should be compassionate to all beings, and you should be kind and loving and grateful, and you should be generous. You should practice meditation in the morning and in the evening. And you should give up all your bad habits, give up smoking and drinking, taking drugs, eating meat, give up everything that's bad, and you should do all these good things. That's very good, isn't it? All of that is good. And I'm right. You should do it. But then what is the result? Is that if I should force this on you, what you're getting is me oppressing you, isn't it? Because the means, it's the wrong means. The ideas are good, but the means I'm using is forcing my will upon you, telling you what you should do, ordering you about, intimidating you, making you keep the rules at gunpoint. You will keep the five precepts as I aim my pistol at your head. And so they remember that the ideas are good, but the means is rotten, isn't it? It's an oppressive, brutal enforcement upon people. So that's what happened to communism. It became a tyranny, rather, even though the ideal was good, the means was not good. And this is very important to realize, that the means have to be suitable to realize the result, the good result. You can't get a good result with bad means. And that's where oftentimes the communists was their great mistake, was that they felt it was all right to exterminate and oppress large numbers of human beings because the result was going to be very good. And you could dismiss these people and get rid of those troublesome types and those kind of capitalist swine and those oppressive aristocrats and those selfish so-and-sos, and just wipe them out, get them out of the way, and you can start with only kind of good people that are left, the proletariat. And then you can build this perfect society based on these wonderful ideas. And what you end up with a tyranny, a fear, the result is obvious, isn't it? And then it cannot last, isn't it? It's not based on any real truth, foundation, not based on Dhamma or anything practically or real. It's based on an idea out of somebody's brain. And Karl Marx thought it up while sitting in London in the British Museum. And it's ironic, isn't it, that Karl Marx's grave is in Highgate Cemetery in London. You can actually go visit, and nobody really goes and pays much attention. You hardly can find it. Because the British have never really taken to Marx communism. Now, morality is oftentimes when I first went to live in England in 1977, and we lived in London for 2 years. We had a house in Northwest London, and therefore I'd been away from the Western world for many years, living in Asia. So during all that time, say from 1963 to 1977, the 60s, the liberated 60s, and all the drugs and freedom and liberation and all of that had taken place, I had missed out on. I had not participated in that. So I was like Rip Van Winkle waking up after 20 years and finding myself in a world I didn't really know anymore. So living in Buddhist monasteries in Thailand from 1966 to 1977, and then moving to England, which I never lived in England before, and having to live in a big city like London. I'd never liked living in big cities, and yet here I found myself living in one of the biggest. So we start out in this house in Northwest London, and then the people would come, and very kind of hippie types, and we'd give talks on keeping moral precepts, not taking drugs and all that, and you'd see that within 5-10 minutes the room would be empty. And just mention the word morality, and that was enough to like you were talking about leprosy or something really horrible. Why is that? Why is morality in the Western mind become regarded as an oppression of or taking away our freedom? Why is that? And when you contemplate it, you begin to see that, like, oftentimes the Victorian morality was oppressive, wasn't it? It was a kind of, you have to keep, you have to be moral, and if you aren't, you'll be ostracized, you'll be rejected, you're bad, you'll go to hell. And so it tended to be the fear conditioning, isn't it? The conditioning through punishment. If you don't keep the moral precepts or the moral commandments, then you're going to be punished. So there was this feeling within the Western mind that it was all hypocrisy, and that it was because a lot of people who would threaten you with eternal damnation were obviously also guilty of a lot of these offenses. So the whole subject of morality seemed to be tainted with this sense of hypocrisy and tyranny, like it was taking away our freedom, it was oppressing our minds. It was false, it wasn't real, it wasn't beautiful. Because if I force morality upon you, then it's not skillful means, is it? To force you to be moral. Because then, even though it is very good, the means I'm using is tyrannical. It's insensitive, it's brutal. It's not allowing you to choose. It's not respecting your intelligence and your ability to be able to love morality and seek to be that way. All I'm doing is intimidating you and condemning you to hell if you refuse. And that can only be a form of tyranny and brutality. One doesn't really respect anybody when you're forcing something onto them. You're treating them like they're stupid and you're telling them what to do. I know what's good for you. You don't know anything. You do what I say and you'll be all right. And so it's the tyrant mentality oppressing the population. So even though, say, communism, I think is quite a good idea, actually. Don't report me to the CIA. I'm really not a political type person, but idea of a system of political, economic system, social system where there's fairness, justice, equality certainly is a very appealing ideal to me. And being moral, living, being responsible for how one lives, taking on the responsibility for one's action and speech, that appeals to me very much. But if somebody is intimidating me, forcing me, then it tends to lose its appeal. One is forced to rebel against it. Or to just blindly follow along because you're frightened and intimidated by it. You just go along with it out of fear and out of stupidity. Now the human mind, isn't it? We can, like on this retreat, trying to bring into your conscious awareness of ideas and ideals and practical ways of solving problems and looking at the conditions of the mind and inspiring the mind. We're all here because we basically love the good. We want to be good. We want to align ourselves with that which is truly, which is true and beautiful and good. So we appeal to the aspiring nature of humanity, to your intelligence and your love of the good, and encourage you and try to provide occasions, opportunities for that to be realized or to encourage you towards that. And that is a skillful means, isn't it? But it means that you have to do it. You have to take on the responsibility. That's your decision to do it or not to do it. So sometimes there's a difference between right understanding and righteous understanding, or self-righteous understanding. When we become self-righteous, then we are oppressing people. We're looking down on them, patronizing them, and even though what we're saying might be very good in its content, in its intention, it's based on stupidity, ignorance, and arrogance. I think we really need to bring back into the human mind our nature, not as a kind of hopeless sinners and selfish people who have to be kind of controlled and manipulated and subdued and contained. I mean, that is one level of our behavior. Admittedly, we can be like that, but we can also rise up and mature, grow in wisdom But this has to be encouraged. This can't be enforced. We need to establish places where this can happen, where people can go, like here in the city of 10,000 Buddhas, or Amaravati, or different centers and monasteries, schools, where people can go and hear the Dhamma and can get some kind of encouragement for their lives. Because the worldly life now is very much based on trying to appeal to the lower instincts, lower natures of humanity. When you look at here in the United States, at what the advertising is implying, is that the American people are quite stupid and silly and selfish and greedy people. It appeals to the basic instincts and desires of the human population, you know, envy, jealousy, keeping up with the Joneses, competitiveness, vanity, wanting security, and that you must always get the best and the new, and get the better. Never be content. Always try to get better and get the best and get more of it. And that type of advertising it's quite powerful, really, a powerful effect on the mind. So it does bring out those kind of feelings in our minds, doesn't it? We can't help but be influenced by that kind of contact. It is strong, and it does, and it has its impact on our minds, whether we like it or not. It still does. The consumers, you're just a bunch of consumers. You're just a body sitting there waiting to consume something. So they're offering you a lot of alternatives for consuming. And this is really looking down on people, isn't it? That if I just look down on you as a consumer, somebody who's going to consume something that I want to, you know, I want to make money by selling this product so you'll buy it and consume it. I'm really not respecting you in your true human state, in your lovely human state, but as a kind of creature that you manipulate and use for your own ends. So what do you get? You get people like that, people that act like that, people that just want to consume, that don't know any better. This is what is the fashion, this is what is popular, this is what we see, this is what we hear, this is what is expected of us in this society. Buy new things, buy lots of new things, spend your money, make lots of money to buy more things. And so it keeps the population on a very immature level, and it's degrading the population. It's not respecting the potential of any human being by treating them in that way. Also, modern education tends to look at children as if they were rats or chickens. You know, the idea of reward and punishment, like giving them electric shocks or sweets. If they do the good, if they do what we want, and then we give them a reward. If they are naughty, then we give them a shock. So that modern education, they say also in Britain, is based on this idea of reward and punishment. This is also looking down on the human state as if we were just a rat, a kind of maybe a slightly more intelligent rat or chimpanzee, maybe. So when, like with children, isn't it? As many of you have children of your own, and you can see from your own experience, you probably know this better than I've never had any children. But if you, I mean, I know from my looking back at my own childhood and working with my children, the monks and nuns, that if I treat them like they were stupid and didn't know anything, and that they and try to force and drive them out of putting fear into their minds, or just to arouse their competitiveness or their intimidate them or exploit them in any way, then of course the whole point of our life is lost. The holy life is just non-existent. And so, say, when I was a child, if I remember when I was in the seventh grade in Seattle, this teacher, horrible teacher, I remember. And she seemed to dislike me. She always on my back and seemed to criticize everything I did. And so I became depressed. And I couldn't do anything. Couldn't do anything at all. And I remember, I have this image of myself at that age. As a kind of outcast boy. And I remember this ugly T-shirt I had. I remember vividly to this day. I remember this ugly T-shirt. It was a kind of beige-colored T-shirt with a hole right in the middle, right where my heart is. And this ugly T-shirt had been washed so many times. It had a kind of all kind of distorted shape, and you put it on. And you felt, you know, it's actually that T-shirt is how I felt, like somebody that was out of shape and with no heart. And I remember myself wearing that ugly T-shirt to school and just being depressed and not being able to do anything. Then, for the eighth grade, we were sent to the high school, so we changed schools. And that summer I was so depressed that I, when I took the entrance examinations for this high school, I couldn't function. So I got very low scores, and I was put in a class for mentally retarded children. So there, and that proved it, as far as I was concerned, I was hopeless. So then, I had a teacher in that class in eighth grade, and she obviously saw that wasn't the case. And so she started encouraging me. This teacher, she was very perceptive kind of teacher. So she started encouraging me. And I started, you know, really working hard. And she said, you can't, I'm going to change you to another class. And she put me in another class of more normal type. Actually, I would like to have stayed with her. She was I'm getting quite fond of her. But I became a very good student and finished high school in 3 years as an honor student. Just through the encouragement of being encouraged rather than being threatened. And I remembered that, how depressing it is to be forced or to be looked down on or to be intimidated by others. And I just, my, you just, You're just denying that person the possibility of doing anything. You're taking away their self-respect. And it's very important not to take away anyone's self-respect or deny, but to encourage. And we find that, in monastic life, I've seen in Thailand sometimes, or I've seen this in meditation or in Buddhist groups in England also, where the teacher becomes a kind of all-powerful being that dominates all the students and tells them what to do. And the students, the disciples, then feel that they can't ever be as wise or as good as the teacher, so they never are. They're always kept down in that relationship to being the kind of disciple that doesn't dare assume that they could ever be enlightened or be a realized human being, because the teacher has become too exalted, too high, and is too strong and too powerful. And maybe dominates and wants to do everything and tell everybody what to do. So in Thailand, some Western monks, they've been in monastic orders for ages, and they come back to England for a visit, and they're just absolutely terrified of everything, because they feel they can't cope with this and they can't cope with that. They've been institutionalized by Buddhist monasticism. They've not developed the ability to work with the flow of life. They become very dependent on a very strong teacher and a clearly defined situation. And when they're outside, when those are absent, they have no inner resources, no inner confidence to deal with the contingencies that arise. In Thailand, it's easy to be a monk. 98% of the people are Buddhists, Thai Buddhists, and it's I call it the Bhikkhu's paradise. It's not a very good place for nuns, but it is a good place for monks. And you get adored and worshipped and treated with great respect wherever you go, and like army generals and prime ministers, all these come and bow at your feet, and you don't get that in England. And they all know the rules, and the monasteries, you have very strict Vinaya monasteries, and everything is run in a very clearly defined traditional way, and everybody knows what to do. And so it's very safe. But when you leave that, then you're thrown into, say, like I was, into London, where you're, instead of being respected and adored, people bowing at your feet, they're making obscene gestures and calling you not very pleasant names. Well, not everyone, but it does happen. It doesn't happen in Thailand, but it does in England. Not that often. I don't want to give you the wrong impression, but where one had become very much taken for granted the respect that one was getting in living in Europe, one can't take that for granted. But the Ajahn Chah was a very good teacher, because he encouraged this self-reliance a lot for us to come to terms with ourselves. He wasn't a teacher that was always telling us what to do next. He was always encouraging us to solve our own problems, to really take Dhamma and savor the Dhamma and contemplate it and really make it work for us in our lives in the monastery. And he pushed us through all kinds of difficult experiences sometimes, where say when I first went there, I had this very kind of ideal, kind of hermetic ideal of monastic life, living off in, you know, on the mountaintop, looking at the full moon from the top of the mountain and writing some beautiful haiku poetry, the kind of state of bliss. And not having to be touched by the world and the coarseness of society and responsibilities and all that. Getting away from all that into this realm of tranquility and refinement and beauty, one with nature, mystical experience. The first year, when I was a samanera, this was before I went to see Ajahn Chah, I did have a lot of those experiences. I lived in a little hut in a monastery in Nong Khai province, which is where you go to cross over to Vientiane in Laos. And so I lived in this monastery that my teacher was in Laos. There's a meditation monastery outside of Vientiane, and the teacher would sometimes come over, cross the river, and give me instructions in this monastery in Nong Khai. And there I was left pretty much to myself. People, like there every day, somebody'd bring me a meal, and in the afternoon maybe something to drink. But the rest of the time, about a year, I just lived in this kind of by myself. In this hermetic style. And of course the first few months were pretty horrendous because I wasn't used to it. But once I got through that side of it, suddenly I went into this state of blissful calm. And it was so beautiful a state to be in that I became very attached to it. And had various experiences of really, you know, like monks coming to visit and seeing them coming in the distance and running out the back door, hiding in the bushes. Because I didn't want to speak to anyone. Some of the people, Thai people that would bring the food were, you know, good-hearted people and generous. And I didn't want to even speak to them. Even though they were feeding me, I just wanted to leave me alone kind of feeling, and they were quite understanding. But the within my own mind there was this nasty kind of, don't disrupt my practice, don't disturb my bliss, get out of my way, you guys. So that this kind of practice that gave me these kind of beautiful and refined mental states, and I had a lot of insight. But in actual coping with life, I tended to still resist, I wasn't really capable of dealing with anything. I just had to try to support and hold on to conditions that supported this mental state. It made me more selfish than I've ever been in my life. And I thought, is this what the Buddha meant? Is this nibbana? You know, to become so selfish that all I want is my tranquility and uninterrupted. Some Western people are so arrogant they think, aren't you lucky to have me at your monastery? The following year, I took the higher ordination and my preceptor sent me off to stay with Ajahn Chah, wise move. And then... But Ajahn Chah would never let me never put me in a situation where I could control the environment to the extent that I did during that first year. And I used to feel so frustrated because I remember I was into really sincere and hard practice, so I set up these strict regimes to follow where, you know, you get up at 2 a.m. and you do your breathing and you do this and do that, and then you've got it all set out, and you don't want anything to get in the way. And you're looking forward to doing this over a long period of time to where you can get this very refined kind of tranquility. And while I was doing this, and I was just getting to the point where it was all beginning to go in the way that I wanted it, then suddenly Ajahn Chah would say, Sumedho, we're going off to a ceremony this evening, and we'll be spending the night in one of the branch monasteries. So he took me off to this place right on the Cambodian border. A malarial swamp it was. And anyway, it was just a few huts, and they're just starting this monastery, and it's mosquitoes as big as dragonflies. And there I had to sit there in this fetid heat with these mosquitoes in this crude kind of shelter, and there wasn't any, and sit there all night long while Ajahn Chah talked and joked with the local villagers. And they were laughing and carrying on till 3 a.m. And you know, if you can't go till the teacher dismisses you. So I was sitting there, you know, thinking about my practice falling apart. And here I was, you know, the teacher wouldn't let me go. And eventually when he did let me go, there was no place to go. Then another time, he said in the village, one of the villages, they are having a festival and invited the monks to come and give talks. So he insisted that I go with him, and they had all these loudspeakers blasting away, and it was just this horrendous noise, you know. And you think, I became a Buddhist monk for peace and quiet, and then these people are these kind of electronic sounds, and they love these amplifying systems, loudspeaker systems, you know, up to the highest pitch and kind of screaming, shrill electronic sounds and voices coming through it. It's really a dreadful sense experience. And you have to sit there all night with this, feeling angry and averse. And Ajahn Chah sitting there smiling all the time, looking quite happy and pleased with himself. I thought, this isn't what I didn't become a Buddhist monk for this. And I'm kind of huffy this is not what I want. But then Ajahn Chah had some way really of getting us to look at this in ourselves. And because at that time my Thai wasn't very good, and yet he could always make me look at myself in some way. He had good timing, in other words. He seemed to have a really superb sense of timing. So he could kind of wait and kind of bait you and get you going, and then suddenly make you look at what you're doing. And I found that very helpful to me, because I was such a complaining person. I had a mind that just complained about everything and was just kind of whining away half the time. And I realized so much of my life was quite miserable because of that. I mean, long before I became a monk, there is this kind of whinging, kind of wimpy thing in me that was, I don't like that, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and it's not fair, and I don't, you know, I don't think I can, and I didn't become a monk for this, and these kind of energies I began to really observe, listen to them, watch them, and see Then ask myself, do I really want to be like that? Is that the kind of person I want to be? A kind of whining, weak male that just complains and goes through life in this kind of awful way? Is that what I really want to be? No, I don't want to be like that. So in that investigation, in seeing this, then there was a real determination to snap out of it, as Lucy reminded. To stop it, not follow into those modes, those bad habits of complaining and moaning about life. And it was through that, through Ajahn Chah's pointing this out. He never said, I shouldn't complain. He never said, Sumato, you shouldn't complain about anything. He would just have a very skillful means of letting me look at complaining. And then I could see, and see what a miserable condition that is to be attached to. You become weary of it then, this nipita, this weary of that kind of mental habit. It's wearisome. And when you become weary of it and you can see it in that objective way, you realize how you can let go of it. You needn't carry on. You're not that. That's not what you are. You have a choice. You can follow it and just be carried along into that, or you can stop it, step out of it, not follow it. So there is the encouragement, even though Ajahn Chah was a fairly strong teacher, he was not a domineering one. He encouraged us to practice. When we are encouraged and when we realize we can, then we rise up. We can rise up to situations. I've seen so many people rise up to do things that they think they can't do. They have an amazing ability to rise up to life and do what we think we can't do. If you think about yourself very much, you'll end up thinking you can't do anything. Just thinking about oneself from the conditioned mind, you end up feeling depressed and totally incapable of doing anything. So in our custom is to memorize the monastic rules in Pali. The 227 rules in the Theravada Padimokkha or discipline. And this is expected, the monks are expected to memorize this, memorize it. When I first heard this done, this Padimokkha recited by a Thai monk, the first time I listened to it, and I was totally amazed. I thought, that's remarkable that monk can sit there about 45 minutes and go, blah, 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 just like a Virginia tobacco auctioneer. Yeah. 227 rules and in Pali language, you didn't understand a word of it. So I was impressed, but then the cynic came in and I said, oh, that's rubbish. That's not necessary. The Buddha didn't mean that. I mean, you know, that's just clinging to rites and rituals. The Buddha certainly didn't expect us to go memorizing words that we don't understand and sit there for 45 minutes reciting it like a parrot. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to make sure that I don't do that. So this was my reaction. But then, Ajahn Chah never once suggested I should do it. In fact, he did suggest that I should do it, but he didn't kind of, you know, there was not any kind of compulsion there. So then, And I thought, I can't do it. Like, I just don't have that kind of a memory, because in the schools here, we were almost discouraged from rote memorizing. At least my generation, we were definitely, it was regarded as a total waste of time and even damaging. So, you know, I'd never bothered to memorize anything, really. So I thought I couldn't do it. And so then when the second year I was with Ajahn Chah, I asked to go off, because I still had these great longings for this hermetic life of being alone, not being with a lot of other monks, on a mountaintop. So I found this mountaintop in Sukhul Nakhon province, beautiful place, on top of a hill, and where I could be alone. And there were two other Thai monks with me who were also looking for the same thing. And during this 6 months I was there on this mountaintop, we had to go down this mountain every morning before dawn to collect the alms food. It was quite a long walk, so we had to wait at the bottom in this kind of shed, and the village people would walk several miles from their village bringing us the food, and then we'd have to walk back up the mountain. We'd get back to the top about 11 o'clock in the morning, just time to eat before 12 noon. And so during these long walks down the hill, down this mountain, I don't know whether it's a hill or a mountain, but it's one or the other, or both. And I decided that I would try to learn a chant, the chanting of sharing of blessings and merits, because this is a common chant that monks were expected to do. And it's not all that long, but I thought, well, it'll probably take me 6 months to learn this chant. So I could learn to read Thai by this time. I taught myself the Thai script, so I changed the kind of Thai spellings to suitable English ones that I could kind of figure out. And I took this little piece of paper with me as I walked down the mountain that morning. And by the time I got back, I completely memorized the whole chant. Amazing. I thought it was going to take 6 months. And I've learned it in, you know, and I wasn't memorizing it all that time. So I discovered I had a very good retentive memory. So then I started just learning chants, and finally I did learn the 227 rules. And yet, if at the beginning I thought I couldn't do it, and yet when I went ahead and did it, and went against the resistance and the fear and the doubt, and just got on with it, I found out I could do all kinds of things that I thought I couldn't do. So that's why the intending, make your intention, this realization of truth, the perfect intention, total and complete enlightenment, being completely free from all delusions in this lifetime, then if you think about it, you think you can't do it. So don't think about it all that much, whether you can or can't do it, just do it. We have amazing capacities as human beings to perform miracles and do all kinds of things that on the condition level of how what you think of yourself, you think you can't do. We limit ourselves all the time to mediocrity and inferiority through this believing of the conditions of our minds. So we end up being inferior and mediocre. And then the suffering, the self-identity, the ignorance, the misery that comes from being somebody who has all kinds of fears and complaints and so forth, we end up, say, as we get older, it gets worse and worse. You can see, just like, you know, the result of a person's life. Really notice old people. What are they like? And you know, how have they lived their lives? What have they done with their life? Because they are the result of having lived, say, so many years, 70, 80 years, 90 years. And if they've lived a selfish life, or they've limited themselves with their fears and desires, and have never tried to transcend anything, never aimed at anything other than just getting by on the level of mediocrity or just the path of least resistance, they are rather pathetic. They get older, they're just a whine, complaint, grumpiness, blame, and this miserable mental state till you die, till the body decides to pack up. And you see in England, in old people's homes, just even very nice ones, just like old women just sitting like zombies around a television set all day waiting to die. It's really sad. It's these kind of vacant, sad-looking old ladies just waiting to die. And just spending the day watching their eyes on the television, and then maybe playing solitaire or bingo or something, go to the bingo hall for a night's outing, waiting to die. They've not been encouraged, not been inspired, not been given opportunity to use their lives for this development of understanding, perfect enlightenment. They probably never heard the Dhamma, never had the chance, never been encouraged in any way. I don't know. Maybe they have, and they haven't done it. But it is a sad state when our old people end up as being stupid and frivolous and silly. Because the thing is to learn from life. Then as we get old, our lives, we have a lot to give to the young. When we live our lives wisely, then there's wisdom and there's a life of experience. We've learned the lessons of our human state, and we can offer, we can help, we can encourage the younger people to try to live in a way that they can also hear the Dhamma and practice, so that when they get old, they will be able to pass this on. And you can live your lifespan as a brave and courageous human being that learns from life till the big moment at the end, the death moment, which is an important event. How many of you ever thought death as an important event? Most people regard it as an unwanted event or a frightening one, but death is to be respected, and it's the end of this life, so that it's something we should be ready for. Not just let it happen, but prepare for it, because it is the most important event after enlightenment. So, in the way I use enlightenment, I'm not talking about anything fantastic, but just being more and more in the light, using wisdom and working with life, learning from life. And these teachings say that the Four Noble Truths are very helpful to bring our attention to the way things are, so that we can see clearly and know the truth. We don't have that much ability to control everything, we do the best we can to help and support and encourage and live in the society in a way that we are benefiting that society, but none of us are in a position where we have control over it to make it do what it should do. But we can take that kind of opportunity in our life to direct our lives in the right way and to learn, to investigate the Dhamma and to learn from our experience how to live, how to sit, stand, walk, lie down, how to relate to other creatures, how to live in a way that our existence in this form is at least not cursing, not destroying, not harming this planet, and also to live in a way that our existence in this form can even be a blessing. When you, during this retreat, if you try to think too much about these things, then you do get confused. So notice that if you're trying to figure it all out, you end up really being confused. So be with what you know, really be aware of the result of your practice, the way you are. So sometimes you can understand the theory and the clear images or the explanations given, but remember that if you attach to those and think that you really understand because you understand the words, then you're in for a disappointment. So all I'm doing is encouraging you, trying to plant the seeds, and then remember to be patient rather than try to force things. If you're trying too hard and you're getting just too tense or confused or a headache, then stop. Practice not meditating. Just relax. Say to yourself, take it easy, relax. You see, I'm trying to think, what is that desire really like? Is that desire to become, or is that desire to get rid of? You're going about it in that way, then you're going to just get a headache and get the disillusion. So when you find yourself kind of going at it too hard, then stop, relax. Just relax and be at ease. This sense of not having to do anything, not having to go anywhere. This retreat is not a matter of gaining, is it? You don't have to get anything out of this retreat. So that when I used to use that as a reflection. Don't have to do anything, don't have to go anywhere, just sit. And that would kind of relieve the kind of feeling I should be really getting in there and practicing, because that kind of compulsive, obsessive tendency was very strong. And getting in there and finding out, hard work, and really being really very serious about it all. And then you get into a state of tension and strife and stress. So when you reflect, you see what is the result of you're feeling stressed and confused, then just let go of it. Just relax. Be at ease. So that the suggestions I make are not telling you to do things, that you have, like following orders, but it's like planting seeds. Let them kind of germinate, and try to find peace on this retreat, without trying to become peaceful. Just to trust in what you're doing, and to allow that which arises in your consciousness to be what it is. In meditation, sometimes the things will come up into our consciousness. The fears and anxieties and anger and that maybe we don't allow into our consciousness. So don't worry about it. If you find yourself feeling very angry or very upset or very frightened, because regard it as a kind of purification where you're allowing these things to be things that you've not wanted into conscious awareness. You're letting them in. It's like, I'd like to describe it like the inner prisoners. You're keeping all these prisoners in your mind. They're in here. And they're trying to get out. And every time they try to get out of your head, you slam the door and shut them back in. So that's like repression. So you think, if they get out, they'll take you over. You know, they'll take you over, they'll kill you. So you're busy just trying to keep the prison door shut and locked. So there's this tension all the time, trying to hold it all, to keep the door shut, because they're always trying to get out. And then meditation, sometimes by accident, you lose your ability to hold the door shut, and it opens. What happens? They run away. And you say, bye-bye. You've liberated these wretched beings. You've actually been a bodhisattva. You've actually freed them from their torture and misery. Where you thought you were keeping them in prison, when actually you thought that's what you had to do, is keep them in the prison, when actually you're letting them out of the prison. So sometimes what comes out can be pretty nasty stuff, but it's actually running away from you. Let it go. Let it run away from you. Compared sometimes to taking an enema. What comes out is not very pleasant or very nice, but it's very cleansing. So this is where you need to be encouraged to allow the fears and anger and that too. It's through conscious, through letting them through the door of consciousness that they can go away. And your mind's freed from that pressure and that misery. So that's why it's a matter of being relaxed and at ease and open, using the situation here, the schedule of the retreat, the posture, breathing as reference points, not as attachment. The attitude then is being at ease with the way it is, attentive, alert, and observing but don't make observing even to a compulsive observing. Just trust that there is that in you which knows the truth. This evening is the full moon night of June. So our custom is to sit up all night. But I don't particularly want to sit up all night. So, So I thought maybe we could practice till 12 midnight. And for the retreatants, you're welcome to join in on this vigil till 12 midnight. And you don't have to, but you're invited to join us.